This is All In. I'm Taylor Bennett. Today we're talking about plastic waste during the pandemic and the larger conversations happening around recycling in the state. If you have questions or comments on our show today, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881. Just give your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we'll do our best to get it into the conversation. Again, that number is 866-476-3881. You can also send us high-quality voice messages with our smartphone app. It's called All In Vox Pop. It's free, easy to use. You just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Today, we're joined by two guests. Allison Mitchell is Executive Director of the Indiana Recycling Coalition. Hello, Allison.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. We also have Cassia Patel, the Program Director for Oceanic Global. Welcome, Cassia.
Hi. Yeah, thank you. Excited to be here.
Well, thank you both so much. I appreciate your time. A very interesting topic we have today. And Allison, I wanted to start with you. Our environment and energy reporter, Rebecca Thiel, recently did a report on reusable bags in grocery stores. And I think there's been a little bit of confusion since the pandemic started about whether it's safe to use them. You know, when you go to a store, should you bring them? And I guess I just want to find out, what's the latest on that? Is there still a consensus on the reusable bags when you go to a store?
Yeah, that's a great question. And there has been a lot of confusion around this, especially because stores have sort of shifted their policies over time and not all at once. So generally, the consensus on this is that, yes, those reusable bags are safe to use, with a couple of caveats on that. You should make sure you're bringing in clean bags that you can control and you can wash. And in different locations, the stores may require that you do the bagging. So if you want to bring your reusable bags, be prepared to do your own bagging. That can vary from retail location to retail location, but that's a good thought to have in mind.
Yeah, because I know right at the beginning, and it seemed like most of the year when you'd go to a grocery store, there were signs posted or they were stopping you if you were bringing in your reusable bags. Are many stores still banning them, though?
It's a mixed bag, but when pun intended there. but when you look across the different chains, most of them are allowing you to bring your bags and use them. One thing that's been tricky is during COVID, there's been a lot of curbside pickup. That which forces people to use plastic bags because obviously they can't do their own bagging in a curbside situation. And what's added to the confusion here is that the recycling of that plastic film, those single-use bags, has been restricted in some cases, and those restrictions are going away as well. So, but for the most part, stores have started to lift those restrictions on bringing your own bag.
Okay. So again, you know, it kind of goes back to if you don't use your own bag, you still have the plastic bags and the impact that could have on the environment over time.
Right. Yeah. It's always better to use your own bag when you can and you can control the situation. But if you aren't and you have to use a plastic single-use bag, then you should always do your best to gather those up and bring them back to retail stores for recycling.
Okay. Well, Cassia, your group focuses on plastic waste, among other things. Do you think the reusable bag bans during the pandemic have been an issue around the country or even maybe around the world? What's going on nationally with that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we did see around March of last year, when the pandemic really began to hit the U.S. And we started to head into lockdown, that the plastics industry came in really loudly and really vocally at the beginning of that to assure everyone that single-use plastics was the safest choice. At this point, we know now that that is not true. And we actually can endorse that with statements from the CDC, from the WHO, from scientists who have looked at the safety of reusables and how the virus transmits. And actually, the virus lasts on plastic longer than many other materials, including paper. And so it actually is much safer to be using reusable bags that are regularly sanitized than to be using something that's single-use plastic that might have passed through many chains of hands. And so Anyways, just keeping that in mind, we did see in that confusion and that misinformation that was spread around the safety of reusables and the perceived safety of single-use plastics, we did see many of the existing bag bans actually roll back or be delayed. And one example of that I can share, New York State now has a bag ban that's in place that went into effect in October. It was supposed to go into effect in March. That got shifted back to April, and that got shifted back to October in no small part because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And so and we did see that happen across the country. At this point, many of those bans have been put back into place or have proceeded to go into effect, like the New York one, which is wonderful and really exciting. There's also a lot of confusion around how those bans are going into effect, because it's new for most places. There are currently 8 states in the U.S. that do have statewide plastic bag bans. And, you know, that applies to specific cases. As Allison mentioned, curbside pickup throws a wrench in things. There's also different restrictions for retailers versus food delivery. So in many of the bans, food delivery is actually not included. And as we're sitting at home, many of us are still working from home. We are often ordering food delivery, or that's the primary way that we're actually interfacing with businesses. And so there's certainly still a lot of single-use plastic bags that are being used. But I did just want to mention that the safety of single-use plastics is not something that is an absolute. And we do actually have many resources about that on our website. And I can share that towards the end as well.
Yeah, you know, even though the science, I think, will tell you that it is okay, the reusable bags, do you think that enough people know that it is safe at this point, that you're not carrying around the germs with these reusable bags?
I don't think enough people know. And we're actually working at a national level with a coalition of other nonprofits and groups to launch a reuse is safe campaign or something along those lines. Maybe not those exact words, but we are working on a consumer facing campaign and an identity statement to actually just show how many people do believe and endorse that. And the fact that reusables can be safe, again, with all of the proper hygiene and disinfectant protocols in place. Just to increase that confidence, because at this point, we're all speculating how people feel. And it's really difficult to pinpoint that without actually asking people or having some sort of survey or response or just speaking to people directly. And restaurants are also trying to guess. And we see this across the food service industry, where people are offering, even for sit down dining, they're offering cutlery that's wrapped in plastic bags unnecessarily, because it gives this perceived notion of safety. And that's where I just want to caution that from our perspective, the plastics industry really did an effective communication job at coming in loudly and strongly towards the beginning of all this to assert that single-use plastics was the safest choice, and that wrapping everything in multiple layers of plastic would be the safest option, when that actually is not true. And actually, one example of that we know, to kind of just bring this to maybe a more detailed example, gloves, so single-use plastic gloves that many food service workers are using beyond the restricted and required food safety operations are actually could actually lead to spreading viruses or spreading contaminants further, instead of just having a sanitize your hands every 15 minutes policy, which would actually prevent the spread of anything and make sure that you're constantly disinfecting. So gloves can give a false sense of security. And that's just one example where we know that having the additional plastic is not beneficial.
Right. I think it kind of goes back to, you know, in the beginning, there was just a lot of misinformation surrounding the pandemic. So I think people were probably just a little unsure, you know, what was safe. I know, you know, when you went to the grocery back when it all started, you came back home and you disinfected everything, the bags, and you left them out in the garage. And so I think, you know, again, there was just probably just a lot of misinformation there at the start of everything.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just also want to highlight that it is very important for us to take care of ourselves and our communities and our employees. And that's absolutely top of mind for all of us. And I think just with the benefit of time at this point, now that we have been living in these conditions for a while, we have caught up to some of that understanding, at least. And so we can more confidently assert that reusables can be safe, and you know, we can find ways to make that a reality. Actually, I know a lot of friends and colleagues even would, from going to the grocery store, would just put items directly into the cart and then unpack them by putting them from the cart into their car, and just avoiding the use of bags altogether, and then, you know, disinfecting or leaving them as they thought was appropriate. So, you know, people are getting creative, but wanting to also find convenient ways for people to make sustainable choices. services is important too. Mm-hmm.
We have to go to a break in a couple of minutes, but Allison, I wanted to ask you, how important are the small items like plastic bags and the plastic straws when we talk about the environmental issues? What makes them so unique?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Those items are small, they're ubiquitous, and they are not recyclable in your curbside bin. And I think a lot of people are still under the impression that if it's plastic at all, I can throw it in my curbside bin and somebody will figure it out and it will make its way into recycling and everything will be perfect. And that's not the case. So things like the plastic film bags for shopping, those are recyclable, but in a separate stream, but in a return to retail location. All of those other smaller bits of plastic, and the pandemic, we're seeing new versions of this, right? With the gloves, the wipes, most of the sanitizing wipes that you find with disinfectant on them are actually made from polyester and they are plastic. The gloves, the disposable face masks, most of those things are made out of plastic and they are creating a lot of havoc at recycling facilities. So people need to understand to try to choose something that is not single use whenever possible. And that includes all those things you're doing for safety, for COVID reasons, and do not put any of those things in your recycling bin.
Definitely. I mean, it's those little things that do add up, like the straws and those small little plastic bags that, you know, those plastic silverware comes in that you have to think about when it comes to recycling.
Right. Yeah. Those plastic packaged flatware sets that you get in carry out are very ubiquitous right now, especially with all the carry out. And it's kind of silly if you think about it, because where are we taking that food home where we have cutlery? So I really hope that restaurants are seeing that as an opportunity to cut back on that expense and therefore waste less, spend less, and it would be a net win. And hopefully that is a practice that continues beyond the pandemic, of just the simple thing of asking. Maybe you have to place the order for it just like you would for an extra side of ketchup, that you would have to ask for the cutlery. That would be a good thing to follow.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. All right. We'll be right back with our guest after just a quick break. We're talking with a live panel about plastic waste and recycling in Indiana. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Taylor Bennett. We'll be right back. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Taylor Bennett. We're talking today about plastic waste during the pandemic and the larger conversations happening around recycling in the state. We love your questions and comments on the topic. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from. That number is 866-476-3881. And don't forget, you can also send us a voice message through our free smartphone app. It's called All In Vox Pop. You just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store, send us your question or comment, and we'll try to get it onto the show today. We're joined by two guests, Allison Mitchell, Executive Director of the Indiana Recycling Coalition, and also Cassia Patel, Program Director for Oceanic Global. We were talking right before we took a little break about some of the smaller items like plastic bags and the plastic straws when we talk about the environmental issues. And Cassie, I wanted to talk to you about what your group works on as far as the large scale efforts around some of these things. And what role do these small items like this play in when it comes into like recycling?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, Allison, you're really, really touching upon the heart of that there. That many of these items are unnecessary, particularly as we're sitting at home. We don't need forks and knives if we have those at home. Just thinking through the quantity of the choices that we make in our daily lives, it really does add up. Our work at Oceanic Global spans between two primary pillars of action. We focus on what we can do at the individual and the community level. How can we be taking action and changing our behavior in our own lives? And then we look at the the industry level. So how can we be engaging businesses to really create a shift at scale and to begin to move the needle in the direction that we need to. So engaging with restaurants and hotels and music festivals and stadiums to help them shift away from single-use plastics and improve their waste management practices on site as well. So that we're really then shifting the market, shifting the demand, and hopefully building a new structure around consumption there. To give you a perspective globally, about 1 million single-use plastic water bottles are consumed or purchased every minute. So that one action of choosing to buy a water bottle really can scale up. And we saw that certainly with straws and saying, it's every individual person's choice does add up and make a large difference. And it may not feel that way if you're just thinking about yourself or in your community, but even just a restaurant or a cafe making a different choice can then touch the lives of everyone within that ecosystem of staff and employees and visitors and guests. And so that's really where it starts to scale. And that's why we get so excited about working with, these centers of culture, like music festivals and sports stadiums, where people come to also be inspired and to look up to their role models, whether those are musicians or athletes or actors and actresses. And so seeing how some of their role models could be making better choices, if that's the team decisions or if that's the stadium's decision, and just finding ways to engage communities. If that's as simple as just bringing your own reusable water bottle to a sports game, or going beyond that and seeing how you can actually fully transition to a reusable takeaway system citywide. And we're seeing these pop up in New York City, in San Francisco, in Toronto, and elsewhere, in Colorado here actually as well, just looking at how this can be adopted. But we do need that desire, both at the grassroots level, at the consumer desire, so that businesses have the confidence to go ahead and do that. We need businesses to be leaders in this movement by taking that risk, and to be pioneers and the first ones to make that choice and to stumble through the challenges that will come along with changing a system. We need the innovators who are creating these solutions, these innovative and unique reusable systems for infrastructure, or these disposable options that are alternative to single-use plastics, but that can that are truly compostable in every situation. And I'm sure Allison can share more about the waste management side of things there too. And then also the policy aspect. So I know we started our conversation around bag bans, but political legislation and policy tools are so critical to just continue this shift, because not only does that create a legal framework with which to define our values and as a society, but it also gives incentive for innovators and entrepreneurs to meet that challenge and to find solutions and to help us all move in that direction. So even if I mentioned earlier, there are some challenges around bag bans and the way that they're currently structured, this is definitely putting us in the right direction. A Closed Loop Partners, which is a wonderful consortium that really inspires and supports entrepreneurs, but also an investment group. They just recently hosted a bag challenge, and some of the innovators and solutions coming out of that are really incredible. But that only happens when there's investment, when there's policy that's driving that change. So it's just exciting to see what's happening. So I guess in short, our work at Oceanic Global is trying to pull all those levers in the directions that we can, so we can shift towards a regenerative and reusable future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I definitely want to talk about policy issues around recycling, and I don't mean to keep going back to plastic straws, but I just find it's interesting because a few years ago there was this huge push to ban them, and it seems like it was an interesting case study, Cassia, especially for groups like yours. And then you saw this change from going away from the plastic straws to the paper ones. How does something like that happen?
Yeah, so that's actually a great example. That's actually how we launched our industry program, which is called the Oceanic Standard. So we're headquartered in New York City, and the city council we'd been in touch with there was considering promoting a ban on single-use plastic straws. But they wanted to make sure that industry was ready, that there were actually marketable alternatives, that businesses could evolve and adapt if that legislation were rolled out. So we engaged with our restaurant community, restaurants and hotels and bars and cafes throughout the city. And we actually were able to get 100 businesses to shift their purchasing away from single-use plastic straws, primarily implementing paper straws. At this point, there are so many other alternatives. For those of you who get frustrated if a paper straw disintegrates in your drink, there are wonderful alternatives made out of agricultural waste and pasta and hay and seaweed. And so, people are getting very creative, as I said, again, with that sparks innovation once you do have those bans in place. But once we were able to get those 100 businesses on board and as advocates for the program, the city council then had the confidence they needed to move forwards with that legislation. It still hasn't yet been voted into effect. We're putting pressure on the city council to do that, but it was proposed, and there have been a few hearings on the topic, and it was just wonderful to see how that was a great gateway item to start talking about a banning of single-use plastic items. And now there are many other bills on the docket for New York City and beyond, looking at utensils and other and beverage cups and other items that are habitually used that we can be tackling. So it's a great initial step because many people don't actually need plastic straws. There are some people who do need plastic straws based on their abilities, but most people don't need that. So it makes it easier to eliminate than a plastic cup, for example, whereas, you know, it's really hard to find some alternatives to single-use plastic cups. So it just makes it an easier gateway access. And in general, we see plastic and waste as a wonderful gateway to responsible consumption more holistically, because it is so consumer facing, it's so physical and tangible, and many people have their own stories around how plastic pollution is destroying some of their favorite places, beaches, town parks, streets, even that they frequent and that are special places for them. And so because of that visible nature of plastic pollution, it's a great way to begin somebody's journey, whereas clean energy might be a bit more opaque and invisible. So starting with plastic and moving from there and having some small wins is always really important to get new activists involved and engaged so that people can really see the impact of their own decisions.
Right. Allison, when it comes to recycling here in Indiana, how's the state doing? Are we pretty bad at recycling?
So that's a great question. The national average for recycling, and this is, you know, curbside generally, also in rural places, it's drop-off locations. The national average is about 35%. The state of Indiana has a recycling rate that hovers right around 20%. So we are well below the national average. And that's really a shame, because when it comes to recycling, Indiana has some of the best infrastructure in the entire country to do recycling and to do it really well. We have the end markets. Those are the manufacturers that want those recycled materials, such as plastic, aluminum, paper, and fiber, and glass. And we have the infrastructure to move it there very quickly. We are the crossroads of America. So we have all of the transportation infrastructure that means we can move it very quickly within our state and across our state to other states, that makes the hauling of those materials very, very cost effective. So it's a big area of opportunity for the state of Indiana to make investments in education at the consumer level, so that people understand the role of recycling in a more sustainable and more prosperous economy for the state of Indiana and beyond, as well as the infrastructure to help citizens get that recyclable material into a bin, into a materials recovery facility where it gets sorted and baled with other like materials and then sold to manufacturers who then use it to create new products. So we've got two really critical ends of the cycle here in the state of Indiana, but there are real significant gaps in between that need investment, and the job potential is really phenomenal, especially when you think beyond just recycling in Indiana and you expand and think more broadly about the circular economy and the opportunities for entrepreneurial growth, the things that Kasia was talking about, where independent folks, very smart people, come in and innovate around a problem to solve that. And in the process, they create jobs and they provide new infrastructure to capture those materials, keep them in use, and prevent the degradation of our environment and our waterways, which all rivers flow to the ocean. Mm-hmm. So although we are a landlocked state, the things we do here impact the ocean. And I think that's something people need to understand. They think, oh, plastic straw, you know, it's just going to go to a landfill. Well, as soon as it goes down a storm drain, you know, it's on a completely different path. And that's not going to end up in a landfill, most likely.
Yeah, I mean, it's very broad. And, you know, even before the pandemic, when we had all these single use items in the packaging, it seemed like Indiana, like you mentioned, we're still struggling to recycle. And I guess I'm just looking for reasons on why this situation has continued not to get any better.
So we, in the state of Indiana, we have not invested in environmental education for generations now. And studies show that where you invest in helping your residents understand the impact of their choices, they're going to make better choices. And that's going to improve the quality of the environment and also the infrastructure to support them in making those decisions. So we have a real burden in the state of Indiana around educating our citizens around why it's important to pay attention to their consumptive behaviors and to make one choice versus another, what the impact that's going to have and what that's going to mean to them as an individual. As Cassia said, you know, the decision to buy bottled water is something that people probably don't stop to pause and think what the impact of that is. But if that ends up as litter, that's going to end up in a roadside. That is going to have a negative impact, not just in that location, but the appearance of our city, of our community, the investments that are made. It sends a lot of signals on top of the economic, or excuse me, the environmental impact that that one water bottle has.
Yeah, it's interesting. And again, I want to talk to you about policy and some of the things maybe that can be done as far as over at the State House. But Cassia, I did want to ask you, as far as across the country, what are you seeing as far as the trends are concerned around recycling?
Yeah, thank you. And I just want to jump back quickly, if it's all right, also just to in thinking about the dangers and the issue of plastic pollution. And as Allison was outlining, there are some significant economic challenges that are caused by plastic pollution, as well as the environmental issues. But there's also a significant public health crisis that's caused by plastic pollution. And so as we are consuming even plastic water bottles is a great example, because we're drinking water out of a plastic container, which has plastic fragments in it. And the longer you leave that out in the heat, especially if you leave a plastic water bottle in a hot car, you know you'll be drinking some of those plastic chemicals. And we don't fully understand how the chemicals used in plastic impact human bodies, but we know that it's not good. And from what we've seen so far, we've also been able to find out that nanoplastic particles can cross the blood-brain barrier. We know that there are endocrine disruptors. We know that there are hormonal changes, developmental defects caused in infants and children from plastics, cancer-causing agents in adults. And so there are a lot of human health challenges posed by plastic pollution. So I think it's important also that we frame it as a public health crisis, which it is. And we are breathing plastic as well. It's in 94% of drinking water in the U.S. and in the air that we're breathing, and even in produce. I have no idea how it gets in produce, but probably through the water. Mm-hmm. And so that's insane. So anyways, just to throw that out there as another reason for education, and another reason to care and to engage. With regards to recycling, I think, I'm sure Allison can also speak more to this from the infrastructure perspective, but our perspective on plastics recycling is that in itself is not a true solution, just because of the lack of infrastructure, as Allison has noted, and the lack of capacity. So about only 9% of all the plastics that has ever been produced has actually ended up being recycled. And in the U.S. in particular, we had been sending and exporting our recyclable plastic waste to China, and they stopped accepting our waste a few years ago. It was called the Green Sword Policy. And so we've been left with this additional material that we don't have the capacity or infrastructure to actually manage. We've continued to export that waste to places in Southeast Asia, to places in Africa, to places in South America, but it is unacceptable for us to be exporting our waste to other countries. And I know Allison might actually note that Indiana as a state might be importing some waste from neighboring states because of the infrastructure that exists there. But anyways, just wanted to note that in terms of recycling, we do not have the infrastructure to handle all of the material that we're creating right now. So thinking of recycling as a silver bullet solution for plastic waste doesn't make any sense from that perspective. And then also, plastic degrades with every life cycle that it is recycled. So a PET bottle can't turn into another PET bottle on its own without adding some virgin material, at least with the existing infrastructure. I know that there are developments on chemical recycling and others that are trying to, you know, maintain the integrity of that structure. But the way that it currently exists, many of those plastic films are actually not recyclable, just depending on which markets exist. And so recycling is an industry and a business in that you have to be able to sell that material. And if you don't have a buyer, then that material doesn't get recycled. And that happens actually often with glass, where glass is very heavy to transport. And in fact, all it is sand. So it doesn't have an inherent value in the way that metal, like aluminum, does. And so actually, there are some haulers, some large haulers that don't even collect glass for recycling. And most of the commercial haulers in New York City, that's the case because of the costs associated with the transportation to proper facilities. So there are many challenges with recycling globally, as well as across the U.S. And I think education is one aspect, but the burden shouldn't always be solely on the consumer. In fact, a very small part of it should be on the consumer. The burden really should be on companies and manufacturers and designers of products and packaging. And we're starting to see that shift also in legislation. So there's a new set of legislation called Extended Producer Responsibility, which is placing that burden on the manufacturer so that manufacturers of plastic packaging would have to then invest in recycling infrastructure. California has a bill up that they have. I can't actually remember if that's been passed or if that's just been proposed. Mm-hmm. I know New York State has just proposed a ban, an EPR bill, which would place that burden again on the manufacturers. So I just wanted to throw that out there as an approach.
Well, thank you, Cassie. Yeah, Allison, when we come back after our break, I want to talk to you about an initiative to improve cycling here in Indianapolis and get a little more into detail and maybe some things also that's going on as far as legislation and environmental bills that we can hopefully maybe see move through the State House. We will be right back after just a quick break. We're talking with a live panel about plastic waste and recycling in Indiana. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. Don't forget, you can also call us at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. I'm Taylor Bennett. We'll be right back. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Taylor Bennett. Back now to our discussion on plastic waste during the pandemic and some of the larger conversations that's happening around recycling in Indiana. And as always, we would love to hear your questions and comments. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a short voicemail with your first name, where you're calling from, and that number, 866-476-3881. We've got two guests with us today, Allison Mitchell, Executive Director of the Indiana Recycling Coalition, and Cassie Patel is the program director for Oceanic Global. Welcome back to the both of you. Allison, I wanted to talk to you about your group. It's been part of an initiative that's improving recycling in Indianapolis for a long time. Can you give us a little background as far as the history is concerned there on that effort to improve recycling here in the city?
Yeah, sure, Taylor. The history of recycling in Indianapolis is very long and very complicated, but suffice it to say that back in the late 80s, we built an incinerator, and that was the Indianapolis Solid Waste Management Plan. We didn't invest in recycling, as many other municipalities of our size did at the time. And so now the recycling rate 30 years later in the city of Indianapolis is about 7%. And as you recall from earlier, the 35% average nationally and the 20% average in Indiana. At 7%, that's pretty sad for Indianapolis.
So you can say that Indianapolis is probably one of the most wasteful cities in the U.S. then.
Yes, it is, especially when you compare it to other cities our size and even here in the Midwest. So that lack of investment in the infrastructure and the education have created that situation today. So my organization is a statewide organization. And we do education and policy to advance recycling. And really, we go beyond recycling and focus on other aspects of the circular economy, which the recycling is a part of. But as Cassia said, not the silver bullet to address all of our issues around waste management. So the board of directors in the last couple of years got together and said, you know, this is pretty bad. We are located in Indianapolis, and the recycling in our backyard is pretty pathetic. We got to do something about this. So we've started working with the city of Indianapolis, and the timing was great because of their Thrive Indianapolis plan, which stated they had a goal of offering curbside recycling to all residents by 2025. I know that feels like a long ways away, and it definitely did in 2018 as well, but that is when all the solid waste management contracts expire. So there's an opportunity for the city to be planning well in advance to improve the infrastructure and, quite honestly, improve the funding that we receive from citizens to manage waste, and the education to get them engaged in this. So a lot of opportunity for improvement, but really it's an initiative that will benefit the entire state, because those curbside materials that you put in your recycling bin, they get sorted out and they get shipped to all four corners of the state, and also here in Indianapolis as well. Those processors that melt the plastic down and then make it into pellets that then are sold to manufacturers that are making things with plastic, and the similar processes for glass, for paper and fiber, and for aluminum and other metals are here in the state of Indiana, and they are desperate for our materials. They are having to, in the case of glass, they are shipping in rail carts, multiple rail carts a day from as far away as Canada on a daily basis to supply their demand for recycled glass.
Oh, that's interesting. How does the rest of the cities around the state do? What's the comparison there?
Most of the other cities around the state are doing much, much better. They did make investments in curbside recycling, and their rates are much better. They're closer to the national average. So it's really Indianapolis and some of the surrounding communities have done, you know, better and worse depending on how much kind of reliance they were putting on that incinerator themselves. But over the years, the smaller communities around the city have been able to adapt and have been able to bring in curbside recycling programs. Even some of those excluded cities that are here within Marion County, such as Speedway and Beech Grove and Lawrence, they have their own curbside recycling programs that they offer to residents, and they're doing just fine. Mm-hmm. So,
well, what kind of policies exist right now in Indiana that have the biggest impact on recycling? Do we have anything in place?
Yeah. So there aren't many policies in the state of Indiana that support recycling. And in fact, we have barriers, policies that act as barriers here in the state of Indiana. And the biggest one, kind of zooming out the furthest, is our landfill tipping fees. The Environmental Research and Education Foundation just recently published their 2020 analysis of municipal solid waste landfill tipping fees, where they show you what all the tipping fees are in all the states across the country, and then they group it by region as well. And a landfill tipping fee is the rate that when your trash hauler fills up the back of his truck and he has to go and dump it somewhere, he has to pay a fee to dump that. And whether it's an incinerator or it's a landfill. So the rate that gets charged is called the tipping fee. And those vary wildly across the country, and a lot of different factors play into it. Indiana's landfill tipping fee is one of the lowest in the entire country, and it is the lowest in the Midwest. So that results in a disincentive for people to consume less and throw away less, but also to recycle. It is literally cheaper to throw it away. So that is the easiest activity, the least path of resistance. So that is the activity that happens most in Indiana. So landfill tipping fee, especially when you're the lowest in your region, you're going to actually attract outside states, neighboring states, to dump their trash in Indiana. So we take on more of an environmental burden than we as citizens actually create because of those types of policies.
Right. What about changing the landfill fees? Could that happen?
Yeah, it definitely could. And in fact, it would be a very healthy source of revenue for the state as well. And different, you know, I am a big proponent, of course, of the that what that funds is related to solid waste. And so there's a lot of opportunity with that increased revenue that we would get from raising the landfill tipping fee to invest in recycling infrastructure, to invest in education, so that Hoosiers know how to recycle, why it's important to recycle, and the impact of that. And we can also make investments in innovation around the circular economy and going beyond recycling. Because as we know, and what the China ban that Kasia mentioned that happened when China banned the recyclables from the world had an impact, a ripple effect impact over the entire industry globally. We know that recycling is not a silver bullet. That is a myth, And we need to get real about that. And in most cases, folks in the industry have gotten real about that. But we need to make investments in accordance and in alignment with that understanding.
All right. Well, we have a voice message from Ben. It's sent to us on our smartphone app, All In Vox Pop. Let's listen to that right now.
Oberweis sells its milk in reusable glass containers. They encourage customers to return those containers. And then I believe Oberweis cleans and sanitizes them before refilling them with milk and selling them again. So that's an example of returnable, reusable packaging. Has there ever been any sort of market research or polling to see if there's a public appetite for a grocery store model where most or all of the products are sold in that kind of returnable, reusable packaging?
What do you think, Kasia?
Yeah, no, that's an incredible question, and I think using the the milkman model, as we call it, is a great example. Just for how we can be shifting back to reusable models. One example I'd love to highlight is actually a company called TerraCycle, and they've launched a program called Loop, which is exactly that. It is groceries delivered to your home in reusable packaging with reusable bags delivered, by their delivery staff and network there. So that's just in its pilot stages across the U.S., but they're looking to expand that. And that's just one example of how some of those vendors in particular, so Häagen-Dazs and Tide, are actually collaborating with the TerraCycle team to redesign their packaging to reusable metal containers or to be using powder tablets instead of plastic wrapped packaging and containers. And so just looking for those ways to be shifting back towards a reusable model. Also, we're seeing this. I mentioned the takeaway containers, but there are many of these companies around the country and around the world that are offering reusable takeaway containers, reusable coffee cups, reusable cups for events. And what they're offering is a logistics and washing service. So exactly to make it easier for businesses that already have so much on their plate and already are potentially strapped for capacity and employees, particularly now, operating at a reduced capacity, these companies can come in and do it and offer those services for businesses. And that can actually be a cost-saving measure. So using reusable cups for a festival, this is an example of a Halloween festival that took place in New York City pre-pandemic, so at least a year and a half ago. But it was a 20,000 capacity event, and they were able to use reusable cups for that event. And they actually managed to save $4,000 because they did that instead of purchasing single-use plastic cups. And so, I think that just illustrates how these alternatives and these solutions can be cost saving. They can be better for our bodies. They can be better for the planet. And they can be inspiring and bringing new jobs to the table. Actually, a recent report by Gaia, which is another nonprofit that was released earlier this week or last week, actually shows that a zero waste economy would create 200 times the amount of jobs that landfill and incinerators can offer. And so this is a job creation mechanism. And it would support local jobs, not export these industries afar, even to other states. So I think that's what's so exciting about all of this.
Right. It is exciting. There's so many positives. Allison, why is it so difficult to get environmental bills through at the State House?
Well, that's a great question. I think that what we need to do a better job of, and I think, the Indiana Recycling Coalition is really focused on, is telling the impact, economic impact. Like Kashi was just saying, the recycling can create a 10 times per ton job impact versus landfill or incineration. And as she mentioned, a 200-fold increase when you think about the broader circular economy. And I know that in this post-COVID or nearly post-COVID world that we are in, we are thinking about reskilling and reemploying a large number of Americans. And if there is one thing Indiana is really poised to do right now, it is take this and run with it. We literally have everything we need. We can change a handful of policies, and we can incentivize and encourage rather than be punitive about this. And it would just kind of step back out of the way and let the marketplace take hold of this, and you would be amazed at what could happen. So I think we need to do a better job of working with our legislators to help them understand the economic impact. And that is really the focus of this particular legislature right now, especially in a post-COVID recovery world.
Do we have anything over there right now moving through?
Not right now. Like I said, though, what we're doing with the Indianapolis Circular Economy Initiative, and you can learn more about that on our website, indianarecycling.org, is we are working at both the local level and the state level, because the policy at both levels have to come together. And we're also hopeful that we'll get some federal legislation that will help kind of coalesce and standardize and incentivize recycling at a broader level as well. So I think policy plays a very important role in incentivizing people, but also we have to invest in the education. We have to get Hoosiers to understand why this is important, why they should care, and why it is a road to recovery in a post-pandemic world.
Yeah. Acacia, your group works with private companies like restaurants and hotels. What have you been able to do with those relationships right now?
Yeah, thank you. And I think definitely, you know, the hospitality and tourism industries have been some of the industries most heavily impacted by the pandemic. And there's a shocking and distressing number of restaurants that have had to close their doors permanently throughout the U.S. and as well as globally. But so it has been a very challenging time for the industry. I will just say, though, amidst the crisis, we actually have still been receiving outreach from businesses that are ready to take action and that are using this quieter period to, review more holistic initiatives that they can be taking on, using the time to be training staff and employees, to be installing water filtration systems, to be looking at their waste management and shifting their contracting to haulers that are reliable or transparent and to whom that they can trust. And so, a lot of these initiatives and a lot of these efforts can take time, and they do require, although we can be as supportive as possible, they do require the initiative of the business itself. And so and the whole team has to be on board, everybody from the dishwashers to the waste sorters to the hosts to the waiters and waitresses. Everyone has to be on board with these initiatives. And so it does take some time to shift that workplace culture. And the education that Allison is emphasizing is so key to that. So whenever we do work with businesses, we spend a lot of time on the employee training and engagement aspects there, because making sure that people can be then ambassadors of the program is so critical to their success. So we have seen a lot of businesses taking the opportunity of this moment to focus on those aspects that do take longer. And I mentioned we did create COVID-19 plastic-free reopening guidelines, and that included a fact sheet highlighting some of the aspects I mentioned towards the beginning of our conversation here around why we can have the confidence that reusables can be safe. We also pulled together a global regulation database, so highlighting countries around the world that have actually that do have very reusable friendly reopening guidance in Australia and Singapore and Europe, and highlighting the specific temperatures for dishwashing, and showing how very specifically and tangibly it can be done. And then alongside that, we did have specific guidance for the restaurant and food service industry. And we outlined specific items and solution providers here in the U.S. as well as globally that people can be looking towards as examples. But really focusing on finding local solutions is always paramount. So through that effort, we actually consulted many of our industry partners and to understand what are the challenges that they're facing right now, where do they need solutions, and how can we help to provide and to support where we can. So that has been ongoing, but things have definitely slowed down, I will say, just on the industry side of things. And we want to be really compassionate and respectful of what everyone's going through. So just offering our resources and support where we can. But I will say that we are inspired by the continued appetite and desire.
Right. Well, it sounds like, there's a lot of efforts out there, and just continuing those efforts, getting the word out and making sure that most people are on board. I know that both of you have put in a lot of work, and even though there is a lot of work to be done, great work on what you're doing. I want to thank you for taking the time today to share all that information with us. Thanks so much, both of you.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Well, today we were talking to Allison Mitchell, the Executive Director of the Indiana Recycling Coalition, and Kasia Patel, who is the Program Director for Oceanic Global. Our producers are Drew Dolan and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our Managing Editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed this theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere that you get your podcast. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Taylor Bennett. Thanks for listening today. This is All In.